Interest rates drop in Europe.
And Greece may be about to drop its prime minister.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Thursday, November 3rd.
Coming up, we'll get the latest on all the big things happening in Europe this morning.
What can we learn from Germany about running a solvent postal service?
And finally, some closure, Steve, on that wardrobe malfunction from 2004.
Closure. I like that. Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Lots of things going on in Europe today. There are reports the Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou is on the verge of resigning, although that has yet to happen. His office says that is not the case.
Meanwhile, news from Brussels that the European Central Bank is lowering its main interest rate by 0.25%.
And of course, the G20 leaders, including President Obama, are discussing the debt crisis in France.
Let's get more on all of this now from Marketplace's Stephen Beard, who joins us from London. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, first, Stephen, tell us what's happening with the Greek prime minister.
Well, there, as you say, have been reports in Athens that George Papandreou is offering to step down and is inviting the opposition to form a government of national unity with his party in order to deal with the debt crisis. The situation, though, is very confused. There are other reports saying, no, Papandreou is really going to cling to power. But whatever happens, it's clear we are entering a new phase of even more acute uncertainty in this crisis. The prospect of a Greek default and Greece's ejection from the Eurozone seems to be looming larger.
All right, well, what about this move from the European Central Bank to cut interest rates?
This was not expected, but it's a further sign of the pressure building in the Eurozone. The Eurozone economy is in an increasingly fragile state. The doubts about the debt crisis are further depressing confidence. And the new president of the European Central Bank clearly believes he had to start cutting rates to help revive confidence.
And finally, Stephen, and sort of interesting that we're coming to this part of it last, all the G20 meetings are meeting in Cannes. Is there anything they're going to do to help solve this problem?
Well, as you say, I mean, the summit's been totally overshadowed by the growing chaos in Athens. The summit was supposed to be the deadline for the Europeans to get their act together and to deal with this debt crisis once and for all. Clearly, that isn't going to happen.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard with us from London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Jeremy.
And let's get some domestic reaction now from our regular Thursday guest, Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us live from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, a lot of news out of Europe this morning. Stephen just laid it out. What do you make of all of it? What's most important?
Well, certainly the situation with Greece is still very important because if Greece actually does default, there's many who fear that could trigger a bank-like run in Europe that spreads to the U.S., which would be a Lehman-like event. And that's something, anything Lehman-esque these days is not acceptable in the U.S. as well. So that's why we've seen so many jitters. There's hopes that the Europeans will figure it out. But I think the important issue here is that the Europeans are on a marathon. They've started on the right path. We keep looking for them to finish a sprint in this process of saving the euro, and it just can't be done with 17 nations, as we've seen, in that kind of timeline.
Well, this all sort of started this week anyway with this move by George Papandreou, the prime minister of Greece, to go to a public referendum to have the public vote on the terms of the bailout. Do you understand at this point why he would have done something like that?
I do understand it, although it was certainly a slap in the face to all other Europeans who had stepped up to do the rescue package for Greece. But let's face it, the austerity programs in Greece, the riots in the streets, the interruptions, the strikes to business, it makes the Occupy Wall Street movement, we're talking about 100 times the anger factor there in terms of the pain they're feeling and what they're reflecting. And so he's trying to stay in power and reflect some democracy, ironically enough, in the process.
Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Well, here at home, as Diane mentioned, of course, the Occupy Wall Street protests are going on all across the country. And in Oakland, California, police clashed with protesters on the streets in the early morning hours, where police reportedly fired tear gas and made between 2 and 3 dozen arrests. At least one person was reportedly injured. And that's just hours after thousands in the Occupy Oakland movement overtook the port there, one of the nation's biggest ports. Reporter Andrew Stelzer is with us now from Oakland with the latest there. Hey, Andrew.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well. Why did these protesters target the port?
To show their strength, to show that they're capable of shutting down a major piece of the economic system. That's the economic system that the Occupy Wall Street protests have been saying are unjust. So Oakland happens to be the location of the fifth largest port in the United States, major economic engine. Also, they're doing it in solidarity with some of the longshoremen in Washington state who've been going through a labor dispute.
I know just in the last few hours, Andrew, police have reportedly fired tear gas at protesters. We've heard even of some injuries. What's the latest there now?
Well, I was just in downtown Oakland less than an hour ago. The protesters tried to reclaim a building, which I believe was abandoned, perhaps foreclosed on by a bank. And there were also a small group of protesters that set some fire to dumpsters in the middle of the street. I haven't spoken to the police, but from what I understand, they came to both put out the fire and also evict the protesters who had taken over the foreclosed building. That's why police moved in. They arrested a few dozen people, and when they made a call on the loudspeaker who was going to be under arrest, they said the people with the shields, or people who had made shields out of cardboard and out of wooden pallets and so on. And so I think they targeted those people, although I don't know exactly who they arrested.
Andrew Stelzer, freelance reporter in Oakland. Andrew, thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, let's talk with a protester now. Alfonso Jaramillo was at the port, and he joins us now from Oakland. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why did you and the other protesters decide to go down to the port of Oakland?
Well, I think people felt that it was important to make an economic impact and let the city of Oakland know, as well as the rest of the world, that, you know, it is one thing to come out and protest, but this time the stakes are much higher and people are willing to do things like, you know, support a general strike.
But a lot of people have looked at this, and even the port has come out and said, look, we're the 99%. Why are you picking on us?
Yes. So most of us are in the 99%, right? But it is a question of, you know, it's not just an issue or two that we're talking about here. We're talking about widespread systemic corruption that we need to address on a global scale. So we need to take, you know, this kind of measures and go further, even if possible, you know, with strikes and, you know, let people know that we're serious about this. It's not, you know, an issue-based kind of movement.
Alfonso Jaramillo joining us from Oakland. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
There's some new analysis this morning on the number of Americans living in poverty. And listen to this figure, Steve. 1 in 15 are living 50% below the poverty
below
line.
Below the poverty line.
Yeah. So it's not just that they're living in poverty, but they are not even at
they're
that
deep
50%.
In poverty. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
A lifeline for them, of course, is the $70 billion a year food stamp program. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports, that program is in the eyes of those in Washington who are trying to cut spending.
The annual budget for food stamps doubled during the recession. Republicans say some of that growth is due to fraud, so they want to hold the food stamp budget at about $71 billion next year. Democrats want to spend about $80 billion. Charities say they wouldn't be able to keep up with demand if food stamp funding were cut. Paula Thornton Greer is a spokeswoman for Feeding America, which supplies food banks.
We're serving 37 million people each year, and that is a 46% increase from 2006.
Some economists say there would also be an impact on the broader economy if less was spent on food stamps. Sheila Zedleski analyzes food stamps at the Urban Institute. She says food stamp spending creates jobs.
You need clerks at the grocery store, truckers, food delivery, food production. It increases demand.
Zedleski says each food stamp dollar spent generates about $1.70 in economic activity. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, more on the poverty front now. Another fact from the study that's out today, the number of folks living near one another in poor communities is on the rise. More now from station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut, and reporter Craig LaMolt.
Here are the list of the pantry days.
People at the New Opportunities Community Action Agency in Meriden, Connecticut, line up for information on food pantries. Jaylene Rodriguez came by to find out about home heating assistance. She lost her job in May, and she says things are pretty tough in Meriden right now.
I see that people want opportunity, but the doors are being shut down.
Meriden's an old industrial town in the center of Connecticut, within 20 minutes of four larger cities. The industry left years ago, and unemployment is more than 10%. A new report by Elizabeth Kneebone of the Brookings Institution looks at what she calls concentrated poverty. That's neighborhoods where at least 40% of people live below the poverty line. And she says it's suburban communities like Meriden that have seen the fastest increase in people living in neighborhoods like that.
And the concern there is as these suburban clusters of poverty grow, that we're creating communities that are walled off or isolated from opportunities like better jobs and better schools.
She says over the last decade, there's been an increase of 2.2 million Americans living in these poverty clusters. That reverses a downward trend that was seen in the booming 1990s. This kind of concentrated poverty nearly doubled in Midwestern metro areas over the last 10 years and increased by a third in southern cities. And it's felt in northeastern towns like Meriden, where Rodriguez says people like her may just have to leave.
Children and family will die here if they stay here in this kind of condition. I'm telling you, with my experience, we will never survive if this keep on.
Are you planning right now that you're going to leave Meriden?
Yeah. Yeah, that's my next goal. If I cannot make it, I will have to leave myself.
She says she's still hoping, though, that a good job will come through. In Connecticut, I'm Craig LaMolt for Marketplace.
A group of U.S. senators has unveiled a plan to rescue the U.S. Postal Service. The plan would allow the USPS to tap the surplus from its retirement fund to help shore up its day-to-day budget. That is one option. Others want the post office to go private completely. As Caitlin Carroll reports now from Berlin, the Germans have already gone that route.
Germany. 1989. Change was in the air. The Berlin Wall was falling. The Cold War was ending, and the German Postal Service was privatizing.
The point was to get it out of the state budget, you know. That was the major point. And the second thing was to get competition.
Harold Gleisner teaches logistics and transportation at the Berlin School for Economics and Law. In the late 80s, Germany's postal service was dependable, but slow and losing money. So in 1995, the German government made Deutsche Post a private business, giving it more control over its operations.
It was a long process.
Gleisner saw that long process firsthand because his father ran a post office. Many post offices were consolidated, retiring workers weren't replaced, and mail routes were centralized. As a private business, Deutsche Post could make these changes without federal approval. But the German government did create one stipulation.
There is a law to make sure that letters are distributed in any corner of the country.
Even with that logistical challenge, Deutsche Post is often touted as a privatization success story. It remained dependable, but also diversified. Deutsche Post now runs DHL, the express mail company, and it's responded well to the internet shopping boom. So the business is healthier, but are the customers any happier? At a flower shop near a post office in Berlin, opinions are mixed.
Finde ich es recht teuer geworden im Gegensatz.
Antje Schmidt says mail seems more expensive now, and the lines are longer. Harold Gleisner says a national postal service doesn't need to be perfect, but it does need to be agile. He says in America, every major decision about mail delivery gets sent to Congress. And for the U.S. Postal Service, those stamps of approval may arrive too late to be effective. In Berlin, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
CBS is out with their earnings today, Steve. And amazingly, the network is still dealing with at least one financial issue from 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction from the Super Bowl?
Oh, who can forget?
Who can forget? Well, an appeals court just ruled that CBS should not have to pay $500,000 fine for that. 7 years later, that ruling came. I guess the judges really wanted to get a good look at that videotape.
That wardrobe malfunction has been fixed beyond the pale now.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
But the problem is we can't even close the book on that now. The Supreme Court still has to have a say.
Well, of course. Today, Groupon will unveil the price of its stock that'll likely start trading tomorrow, valuing the company far less than expected. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports Groupon shares have been selling for more on private markets.
The creation of big public markets for shares of still privately held tech companies has transformed Silicon Valley. Entrepreneurs here can now cash out before their companies even go public. Bubbles can inflate and pop before an IPO.
We're talking about an uninformed market, by and large.
Steve Kam is a Bay Area tech investor. He says private companies like Groupon that trade on so-called secondary markets don't have to disclose a lot of details about their books. That means
uninformed transactions, uninformed buyers and sellers, uninformed pricing. That's the problem with the secondary market.
When Groupon filed to go public, investors finally got a good look at its books and enthusiasm cooled. Jack Coffey's a securities professor at Columbia University.
Sordid things occur in this sort of shadowy world of being part public and part private.
This summer, trades on secondary markets pegged Groupon's value at close to $20 billion. Today, it's roughly half that. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
So here's a new one, Steve.
Yeah.
Banana Republic is going to start selling wine.
The clothier,
yes. The apparel haberdasher is going to start selling wine now. So when you're going online and looking for your khakis or your cashmere sweater, you'll be able to pick up a bottle of Pinot Noir.
Oh, that's very nice. That's one of my favorites.
In today's Midday Extra, we ask, why? And here to talk about that with us is Marketplace's senior editor, Betsy Streisand. Good morning.
Hey, Betsy.
Good morning.
So why is Banana Republic interested in doing something like this?
Well, probably because they think it's going to somehow drive more people into the stores to buy clothes, I'm guessing, since that's the business they're in.
Or online, right, to check
or
things out.
Or to buy clothes online. That's true. One of Banana Republic's designers is designing the labels on the wine. Banana Republic is not actually making the wine. Claude Dubois is making the wine.
You mean the people at the Gap in San Francisco, they don't have like big barrels of grapes over there like stomping around trying to make – that's not what's going on? No.
Nobody told me that, but I guess it's possible.
Well, can this be compared to Fiat 500 or something teaming up with Gucci or these weird little connections that companies make?
Sort of. I mean, today, because of mobile phones, social media, everything's connected. Or everybody thinks everything should be connected, or there may be some kind of profit in trying to connect everything. So the Banana Republic thinking here is that you're going to get dressed nicely for the holidays. You're going to serve wine at the holidays. Bingo. Put the little black dress on the label of the wine. Run your phone past the code. That'll take you into Banana Republic's site. You'll look at the dress. You'll get some party ideas. Maybe you'll get another dress. Claude Dubois, maybe we'll sell you the wine. The one thing that doesn't seem to be happening, though, is that Banana Republic is not going to be selling the wine in its stores, which, if it were actually serving wine in its stores, may do more to boost its holiday business than all this other
Come
stuff.
Come for some wine. Yeah. I mean, is this, Betsy, about brand value? I mean, do people look at brands and say, oh, Banana Republic, you know, I like their khaki pants or whatever, you know, like their blouses, so I'm going to like their wine, too.
Maybe, hopefully. Everybody's trying to figure out how to spread the like from one product to the next. Hmm. You like this, you like that. Your friend likes this, maybe you'll like that. Wine, clothes, chocolate. You know, it's all – everybody's trying to connect everything now in the sales world.
Betsy Streisand, senior editor here at Marketplace. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. And finally, Jeremy, Betsy, Amazon.com's got a new digital book lending library available to Amazon Prime members with Kindle e-readers and the new Kindle Fire, right? The program will start off with only 5,000 titles to choose from with one checkout at a time, and you can only do this once a month. And Amazon Prime, by the way, goes for $79 a year, which leads me to one very important question, I think. Where's the public library again?
It's right around the corner,
Steve.
Free? What, you haven't been there? In the last couple of weeks.
I've been to the public library
We're
many
so
times.
Close
I just don't
to it
I mean,
here.
It's just like people are either going to pay for it or they're going to go to the library. I mean, unless
it's
the convenience,
yeah,
perhaps, of not.
I wonder what the late fees are. Is it possible to rack up late
fees? I think you can keep
fees?
Them. You can keep the books for as long as you want, or there's an extended period of time you can keep them. I'm not absolutely sure how long, but.
Doesn't sound like a library.
I know you can only keep one book at a time. And that's interesting because at the library you can go and get like several and do your thing. So, yeah.
Well, all off right. to the library we go. Yes. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for being with us and for downloading the podcast. Of course, we're online at marketplace.org. And we're on Twitter as well. I'm at Radio Chio.
I'm at Jeremy Hobson.
Have a great day.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.